Greetings, and welcome to Season 2 of Bold Ideas from Vermont. I'm David Roth. Thank you all for joining us today, and I hope you all had some peaceful time over the holiday period, and I hope 2022 is beginning well for each of you. As we begin this new year, we are faced with so many challenges. And in this Season 2 of the Bold Ideas podcast, my goal is to make sure that our conversations lead to action. In many ways, a thematic for Season 2 brings me always a memory of one of my favorite Elvis songs that says just that. It's time for a little less conversation and a little more action.
Hey, a little less conversation, a little more action, please.
We have significant issues facing us in terms of our democracy, our social fabric, our healthcare system, our housing infrastructure. And we begin Season 2 talking about something that is so fundamental, our healthcare. We all know that our healthcare systems are at crisis breaking points here in Vermont and around the country. And our first guest on Season 2 is Sean Tester, the CEO of Northeastern Vermont Regional Hospital, a really remarkable individual who grew up here in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, for whom community and community service is integral to his very existence and certainly to his family's. We're very pleased to have Sean with us today and think it's a very appropriate way to begin Season 2. So welcome, Sean. Sean, thank you again very much for taking the time to talk with me today. This is obviously it's an extraordinary time in human existence, certainly here in the Northeast Kingdom, here in Vermont. We all know and have heard and have read about all of the problems. There's certainly probably more complexities that you can be able to describe, but I really wanted our conversation to focus more on what do we do? What do we do to move ahead, both in terms of policy, in terms of our own communities, in terms of engagement, in terms of action? Because this podcast, as we have in the past, and certainly as we begin our second season, is going to be a lot less about just simply talking about issues and problems and circumstances, but much more focusing on what we will do. What are the actions we can take individually and as communities to help move things ahead and to change dynamics that are obviously very profound and have profound impacts upon so many of us. So with that, I'd ask you to just spend a little bit of time talking about where are we now? Where are we now in the beginning of 2022, and then we can get into some of what needs to get done.
Sure. That's a great opener, David, and I appreciate the question and where you're trying to drive this. It's an interesting time right now, both, you know, in our larger culture, society, community, as well as within the healthcare system and what we're dealing with. And
yes,
you and I today are talking in a moment when my own workforce here at the hospital is in a very fragile state. We are one or two call outs, sick outs of having almost crisis standard of care within many of our departments.
Has that ever happened before in your experience, or really in other people's experience? Is this unprecedented?
This is unprecedented. That is an excellent word for it, because I think if you look back in history, the last time we had a global pandemic like this would have been the 1918, the Spanish flu, right? And back then, our healthcare system looked so completely different. And there's nobody who really deeply understands what that experience was truly like. Today, we have a very complex system. And we do amazing things in healthcare today, right? A great example, you know, I'm going to use a personal example if you'll indulge me a moment, but
sure.
You know, I'm a man of a certain age and I needed to have my routine colonoscopy for the first time ever this year, right? So went through that process over the summer, and you look at everybody involved in what is essentially just routine care. I mean, we had a nurse anesthetist, we had two supporting nurses in that room, we had a surgeon, right? Not counting the counseling I got beforehand to make sure the colon prep went well, right? All for routine preventative care to make sure that I don't have colon cancer or might not develop it. great experience. We got done that colonoscopy. The results came back, and my surgeon said, "Well, we found one polyp. It was precancerous. We nipped it out. Come back in 5 years." Now think about that. 40 years ago, as a matter of fact, 40 years ago today, my grandfather died at age 58 of colon cancer.
Wow.
Right? And so in my mind, I'm like, holy crap, this is kind of a miracle, what we do. But look at the complex systems built around it to provide that very routine, normal standard of care, right? One thing we found with the pandemic is that it strained all our systems and found the cracks in those complex systems and has exploited it, right? So now we've got an entire healthcare system that's straining under the challenges of navigating this huge need for care in our communities. And we have all struggled to cope with that, both at a systems level, and then you bring it down to the personal level and the tremendous strain and workload on our entire workforce. And it's bringing us just about to the breaking point.
To go back to that point of that almost crisis situation, I'm assuming from what you've said, this is a result both of demand relative to the pandemic, but also demand, just generalized demand that takes exactly, as you said, that significant infrastructure of care. Is it one or the other that is straining more than another piece of the system, or in combination? Again, if we were to stress test this a number of years ago, what at this point, what is almost breaking, if not so much of the entire system?
If not everything, right? That's a great question. I would say if you looked at the way we've managed our healthcare system in the United States, but I think you see this in other countries as well. It doesn't matter how you pay for healthcare or what's going on. We've been under tremendous pressure. We've got to control the cost of delivering healthcare, right? And the tremendous cost of the system is a real challenge for us as a nation. So there's been tremendous pressure on increasing efficiency, getting the most out of our teams, and driving the cost curve down. I won't say lowering the cost, but trying to drive the cost curve down. And here in Vermont, we've actually done a very good job of that. If you look at the work of the Green Mountain Care Board, love them or hate them, you know, we've managed to kind of keep that curve at a lower level than it was a decade ago.
Right.
Now, there are two ways to look at that. Great job, we've controlled the cost of healthcare, right? The flip side of that is, we have limited investment in the healthcare system as a result of controlling those costs, right? So the few years, I became CEO of the hospital here in 2018. And then pre-pandemic, we were already struggling with workforce. We were already struggling with the capacity and needs of our aging community to keep up with demand. When you have a small critical access hospital like NVRH, we have four ICU beds, right? There's a tremendous amount of infrastructure around that. There's great staff that we have to support those four ICU beds. But pre-pandemic, on any given day, three out of four of those beds were full, right? With just people needing that intense level of care. Then you hit the pandemic, and what happens is that demand goes up dramatically. And it doesn't take much to really tip us into crisis so that when we fill that fourth ICU bed, two more patients coming in needing ICU level care, what do? Right? We can't wave a wand and create two more ICU beds. We can't wave a wand and add all the staff needed. We can't wave a wand and bring in all the technology needed to support that level of care. And I think that is the question that we face as a nation right now is, do we want just-in-time healthcare, which is what we've been driving to over the last two decades, right? Which is, okay, we have just enough systems and resources in place to meet the demand at that moment. But the moment demand spikes rapidly, like it did with the pandemic, we cannot rapidly adjust to meet that demand.
You know, Sean, I mean, that's an extraordinarily important conversation. Essentially, what you're articulating The glass was already full. The glass was simply already full pre-pandemic. You add another two or three drops and it overflows. And I think that's a different and a new take on the conversation than you often hear nationally, which is why this conversation is so important. I think a lot of people in their head think that this has suddenly been a crisis that has exploded relative to the strains and stresses on our community systems, on our healthcare systems. But to hear you say that we were already, in terms of both care and staffing and workforce, all of the things you articulated, already at not the breaking point, but the rope was taut. The rope was as tight as it could be. A little bit more pull on either side of that rope, things begin to fray. That's a really important way to frame this conversation, and certainly to frame what we do now to address the crisis, which is, as you know better than anyone, doesn't seem to be abating. If anything, it seems to be getting potentially worse before it will get better, as with so many things in life. So the question is, what do we do now? And then what do we do to prepare for the next pandemic? I've spent a lot of time studying 1918, 1919. As you know, that pandemic essentially was a four-year experience, 1918 to 1922. We're only 2 years into this, which in every analysis of what happened 100 years ago suggests a four-year period relative to a global pandemic is not at all out of the question. So we're not nearing the end. I don't necessarily, you may think so. There's no light necessarily at the end of the tunnel. There's still a tunnel. How do we keep moving through that tunnel?
A year ago, if you'd asked me that question, I was feeling pretty hopeful. We were finally getting the vaccine rolled out. We did a great job of getting, 80% of our community vaccinated. I mean, it was really like, okay, we're on this. Right now, I'm feeling a lot more pessimistic. And I think you're right. It's going to be another rough couple of years here ahead of us as we navigate these waves. So what do we do? Right now we are so deep in crisis. We're lurching from crisis to crisis. It's really hard to pick our head up and think right now, what do we do?
And only to interrupt that, we're not only lurching from crisis to crisis in healthcare. That is nationally and globally, we seem to be lurching from crisis to crisis to crisis, which of course makes me think it's some sort of human, we're somehow wired now to go from crisis to crisis. But to your point, certainly within your ecosystem, you're right. It's crisis to crisis.
Yeah, we have seen, I mean, you kind of saw this coming. I feel like the hyper-complex nature of our systems have contributed to the fragility of what we're doing. So, we've got to think about ways to build resiliency and reduce that complexity down, because it doesn't take much in a supply chain, as we know, And when you look at this, look at all the systems that are contributing to the fragility of the healthcare system. It's our education system, right? And how do we train the workforce that we need to support patients? It's the supply chain system and the fragile nature of that to make sure that we have PPE, medications, etc. So we've really got to take a real hard look at how do we, I'll use the word armor those systems, but make them resilient. Right. So that we don't end up in this situation when a crisis occurs. So it comes down to a couple of things. I think workforce is paramount. We've really rapidly got to start building the workforce that we need in our healthcare system to staff up and give the staff that are putting in insane hours here some relief. And I know that's not like it's not going to happen within the next 6 months, but if we can put systems in place, we can start addressing that maybe over the next 12 months.
The workforce challenges right now to getting people to do the jobs that need to be done. Just give us a little bit of an overview. What are those challenges? Is it a question of competent professionals who have gone through the training? Is it a question of resources, finances, compensation, where we are, maybe all of the above?
Yeah, gosh, it's a little bit of all of the above. If you look at Vermont, we have a serious demographic problem, right? I think we're the second oldest state in the nation. And then the Northeast Kingdom is the oldest region in the state of Vermont, right? So it's like compounded layers there. We have lost about 30,000 people out of our workforce, not just healthcare, but our workforce in Vermont over the last decade. You know, and so we're all, anybody who's in business or is running a large complex institution, whether that's education, manufacturing, healthcare, we're all struggling with finding people to fill the jobs that desperately need to be filled here. And this predates the pandemic. I want to remind everybody this.
Right.
So we need to develop strategies that make our region, our very rural region, a very attractive place to live and encourage people to come here.
I think that's absolutely right. Absolutely correct.
So that's number one that's necessary. I got to throw in a comment around housing. We have a housing crisis here as well, and that directly impacts my ability to attract a healthcare workforce. I can't tell you how many times we've made offers to healthcare professionals over the last 2 years who were excited about coming and joining the team here at NVRH, accepted the job, and then backed out because they could not find housing that met their needs.
Now, is that housing that crosses the spectrum from family, single family housing, apartments, whatever it may be? Are there, I mean, obviously we have all heard of and discussed the housing crisis, but to drill down on that a little bit, are you seeing that from the single individual coming to work in the hospital, to the family? Is no one able to find what they need to find in order to live here?
Yeah, you know, when I work with our local stakeholders who are really invested in trying to problem solve this problem, they ask me, what type of housing, what sector do we need to focus on? And I say, yes, because the answer is, frankly, all the above. And one size does not fit all. It could be the young, single hipster who wants to live in a nice condo within walking distance of downtown St. Johnsbury, to the family who's looking for that rural farm lifestyle and is also a medical professional who wants that nice, you know, kind of higher end rural house, and it's everything in between. So I think we just need to try to, I just say, and market rate workforce housing, right? I mean, ironically, I think we do a good job of investing in affordable housing in many ways, even though there is still a lack there. But the absolute lack of market rate does impact affordable housing too. So that's a huge issue. I feel like I'm losing track of all the things I want to say, David. So I apologize.
No, I mean, I'm so far. As you were speaking, I was saying, all right, we need more people. We need to attract those people. We need to house those people. Those are three very significant issues as we keep going.
Right. And then back to the other piece, which is making sure that those people, many of them who are already here in our community, you know, the state of Vermont, we have a very high high school graduation rate. It's like yes, best in the nation, right? And then only about 50% of those people go on to get an advanced degree. College is not the answer to everything. And in fact, I think we need to do more focus on trades to give people the right skills so that they have high quality jobs, regardless of whether they go to the college. But we need to make sure our education system is well aligned for the career opportunities within our communities.
Within the healthcare system, within your ecosystem, what percentage, and just a rough percentage, what percentage require an individual to have gone into higher education?
Oh, gosh. You know, probably here, 75% of the...
That's significant, right? Because right, to your earlier point, yes, of course, college is not necessarily generally, but I've always articulated that a higher education is, I believe, a higher education is critical for everyone, primarily because it gives people the ability to think. It really helps teach thought, critical thought, which I think is a whole other set of issues that we could discuss. But to the extent, again, that part of that funnel into your community requires higher ed at a time when we have, as a society, in some ways, we've stopped investing in our higher ed infrastructures. That's a critical component. If you had said 20%, 30%, but 75%, essentially three quarters of your workforce requires that, we've got to make sure those infrastructures exist.
That's right. And make sure that the education you're providing is well aligned for those jobs. And, you know, you talk about, I happen to sit on the Vermont State College Board of Trustees, so I'm very involved in what's going on here at the state. You know, I talk about another system that's incredibly fragile and made more fragile by the pandemic. It's our higher education system. So
yes,
we've got to shore that up. We've got to invest in it, and we need to make sure that those systems are well in line for the careers available in our communities. Because what that does then, David, is ensure that those young people who grew up here, who have a deep connection to Vermont or the Northeast Kingdom, can see a real meaningful future for themselves here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And we stop exporting those young people.
And I've seen that a lot of, as you know, some of my focus has been in agriculture here. We see the same thing. As farmers have to sell or leave their farms, they're not being new families, not necessarily young, but new farmers are not coming in to replace them at the rate that is necessary to maintain the agricultural infrastructure in Vermont. And so when a family can no longer make ends meet by dairy farming or organic dairy farming or whatever the agricultural venture, and they leave, there isn't a line of families and people waiting to move into that infrastructure. And similarly, within healthcare, again, if we have to make sure that the NEK, the Northeast Kingdom in particular, but Vermont generally, is a place that is seen as not only welcoming but supportive of the people who are necessary to fill these critical roles in our society. And I've always argued, and Sean, we even talked about it when we met the first time, Vermont makes things. We are good at creation of intellectual capital. We create IP from the first globe to cheese, to obviously Fairbanks, to scales, to maple syrup. We create things. And so to the extent that we also can create and be entrepreneurial relative to healthcare, we should be and we must be, but it requires, as you've said, people to want to be here, who can be here, and it makes sense for them to be here as opposed to go somewhere else.
Yep, you're absolutely right, David. Absolutely right.
One of the things, and then I know there are other, I want to, again, we could talk about this for a very long time. It is, to what extent is our current, I want to say national, much more so than Vermont, because Vermont, we do things, I believe, in a better way relative to our community. Is the national polarization or human community polarization, do you see that affecting healthcare? Meaning that we often read stories about healthcare workers or hospitals or frontline workers being almost like in airlines, being assaulted or being affected negatively by a social dynamic or by people who, for whatever reason, do not believe in the system in which they now find themselves, whether it's the medical profession or on an airplane. Do you see that playing a role in this fraying of the cord, or is that tangential, or is it primary?
No, it certainly contributes to the fraying of the cord. I'd say this has been one wild year this past year, and like nothing we've ever experienced. You know, 2 years ago when the pandemic hit full on, healthcare workers were hailed as heroes and saviors.
Absolutely, absolutely. Right?
And then over this past year, as we saw, you know, the strife, this real friction over vaccinate, not vaccinate, you know, there's a component of our community right here in the Northeast Kingdom that feel very strongly that we're doing the wrong thing. I mean, last summer I had a protest outside the hospital over vaccinations, and kind of our staff here were kind of like, holy cow, how is this happening here, right? Never in a million years did we imagine that we'd have an experience like that here.
That's right.
But at a larger issue, David, and I think this gets more at some of the deep, deep challenges we have in our healthcare system, because if you look at some of the major cost drivers within the healthcare system, they are societal ills, right? It's our mental health crisis.
Yes.
It's the substance use disorders that are impacting many of our young people. It's the epidemic of obesity, right? These are driven by our society and culture more than they are by anything we do in the healthcare system. But the healthcare system has the burden of trying to care for people when they're not well, when they are in crisis, when poor lifestyle choices mean that they need a lot more healthcare. And And what I've been pondering, and I don't have a good answer, but how do we fix our culture? How do we create a kinder, gentler society where there isn't this anger with each other, this polarization, the societal angst that drives people to self-medicate or to make poor lifestyle choices, whether it's alcohol or overeating or whatever. And is there an opportunity? Can we explore ways to fix that then have a generational impact on the healthcare delivery system so that we don't have our emergency departments full of people in mental health crisis or not enough beds for treatment facilities for people with substance use disorders? And we need to get serious about that and start trying to fix some of the cultural challenges that we face.
That to me is the most important, I believe, most profound problem. That's the one problem we all as a society don't necessarily spend enough time discussing. And to your very point, I wrote a lot about the pandemic at the beginning of the pandemic, again, given my study of and history of an understanding of what happened 100 years ago. I never would have imagined we would be here today with the controversy over vaccines, the controversy over masks. I mean, Sean, we have, as a society, we've normalized death. Before we normalized wearing a mask, we argue less about death than we argue about masks or vaccines. And that is profoundly disturbing, but it relates to your point. And I think that as a society, we have over a period of time, not a long time, period of time, created this dynamic of winners and losers. If I win, you must lose. Or if you win, that other person must lose, whether it's in business or in healthcare. We have on this podcast, we've talked to so many about, and you and I talked about it a few minutes ago, the necessity for teaching, learning, embracing critical thought. The ability to understand truth and fact and history and what is real in our society. But I believe very personally, Sean, that much of what you said, it actually relates to our ability to love one another. And that's something we don't talk about as a society. You don't see that in the New York Times, that if we truly practiced love, and that's not a, we're certainly not talking about this from a theological perspective. This is just practical community responsibility. The way that we argue, the way that we are opposed is because we are unable to see the person over there as in some ways related to ourselves, related in terms of future, our destiny, our interconnectedness has frayed. That cord that we talked about for healthcare, the cord of interconnectedness in our society has frayed. It's not almost fraying, it has frayed. And I think that, to your point, until we reweave that cord of connectedness, so much of what we have been talking about doesn't get solved. There will be more, and I use this specifically, there'll be Band-Aids, right? I'm sure your offices, the hospital is full of them. We'll have lots of Band-Aids, but we won't fix the problem until that interconnectedness between us becomes something we talk about more than what divides us.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, David. You know, I have watched, you know, I'm a Vermont Republican, okay, which in any other state means that I'm a moderate Democrat, right? And and I remember even a decade ago, I mean, most of my friends are more left-leaning than I am, but we had great, fantastic, engaging, thoughtful conversations around different perspectives. You name the topic, but we could talk about it. And I've watched over the last, especially the last 4 or 5 years, we're no longer able to do that with each other. I'm not able to do that with some of my best friends, some of my own family anymore. And we get into our echo chamber bubbles, whether that's online or whatever, and we've lost the ability to talk to each other. And unfortunately, we do have this winner-take-all mentality in our political system, in society in general. And the problems are too big for winner take all, right? We have to figure out how to talk to each other. We have to figure out how to collaborate. And we need to work together to solve these very challenging and complex systems. And I'm worried. I admit it. I'm very worried.
You know, Sean, it's interesting what you've just said, and I know we'll have this conversation again. I believe so deeply in what you've just said relative to our ability to connect with one another. One of our last podcasts in season one was this wonderful, I had two guests on who are both very close friends, John McClory and Peter Gould. Now, Peter Gould, if you know, wrote Burnt Toast. He was part of the Back to the Land movement. John McClory, as you know, is an NEK.
Oh, I know John. I grew up with his daughters. I mean, yeah.
you could not have two more different political ideologies. But that was between us, John and I talk probably every 2 weeks. And Peter and I talk very, very, very frequently. But it is because of a shared humanity. We don't have to. In fact, I don't want us to agree on everything. Sean, I don't want you and me to agree on everything. But recognizing our humanity, our shared interconnected humanity, I actually think we do that relatively well in Vermont because of the commons. We have a commons. The person who is stuck in the snow, you're going to help that person out of the snow and not ask their party affiliation. and to the end, in fact, Peter Welch said a wonderful thing that when you're at the stop sign, you want the intersection to work. You're not going to worry about what sort of politics are around in the intersection. You just want to make sure that the stoplights work, the intersection works, and people are safe. So again, to the extent, and I'll leave you with the last words here. We've talked about the workforce. We've talked about issues related to training. We've talked about issues related to housing, to making sure people are able to come here to the NEK or just generally enter the healthcare field in a way that is not only good for them and their families, but good for the system. We've talked about, obviously, the cultural dynamics. As we look forward, what do you believe is the short and mid-term future? And what can we do individually to help that short and midterm future be better for the patients that you're serving? And the long-term future, we'll talk about when we see a little bit more of that light at the end of this tunnel.
We just need to remember that we're all human. Everybody's doing their best. We need to remember why we're here, what we're trying to accomplish in the healthcare system, and remind each other that we're doing this for our community. I think everybody's stress levels are so high that everybody's burnt out. We just need to be able to give everybody a little bit of grace. And I think that's the very short term. Like right now, everybody needs a little grace as we try to navigate these next several very challenging months. Continue to invest, like I said, in the workforce and address some of those other issues. One other thing that I like to mention that I probably should have earlier, David, but we do need to really take a hard look at how we pay for healthcare in this country.
Yes.
Our rural system, you know, is so very fragile. And the pandemic really knocked the socks out of a lot of rural hospitals. We need some predictability and stability. And that does mean moving towards a capitated system, I think, where we have predictable payments, we know what the money's coming in, and we don't have to worry that, you know, when we shut down surgeries, that we're going to look at a massive financial gap that impacts our ability to deliver care. So I think that's another major priority. And I think that needs to happen sooner rather than later.
Are there policy proposals right now that are winding their way or that are at least being considered that would begin to address that? Or is that what we need to do?
I think we need to do that. I think we need to have that conversation. What has shocked me, I keep thinking that we're going to start having that conversation, that I'll start hearing it at the national level. That has not happened as far as I can tell. Maybe you've heard something different, but it's shocked the heck out of me that we haven't had that conversation yet. You know, we've benefited tremendously from the federal support. You know, our hospital alone, we've received nearly $10 million. But for that, we'd be in serious financial trouble.
Yes.
And that's great, but that's not fixing the fundamental underlying problem. And I hope that gets addressed as we come out of the pandemic. And like I said, sooner rather than later.
Well, that's part of what we have to do via these conversations is make sure that the people who are working on that legislation hear what you're saying, hear this conversation and act on it. Again, the conversation is wonderful, but the action is what will matter. Well, thank you, Sean. I'm deeply appreciative of your time. I know you and I will see each other and work together, and certainly have more conversations. But you know, you can count on us and this community to support you, and I hope we all do that even more than we have been.
David, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you. I appreciate the time.
So with that, we begin season two of Bold Ideas. As always, please get in touch with us if you have ideas for future podcasts. Please make sure that you engage with me on Twitter, engage with Bold Ideas. Send us an email if you have any questions. Go to www.boldideaspod.com. And we look forward to having even more engagement with you in season two, because again, this is not just about the conversation. This is about the action that will result from that conversation. And you are a very big part of ensuring that that action takes place. Thanks again very much for listening. Speak with you soon.